the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I've bought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about John McTiernan's 1988 film Die Hard and Rennie Harlan's 1990 film Die Hard 2. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
Yeah, glad to be back on the podcast.
Okay. I'm glad to have you back after a 1 week absence, which is our
it's
normal
been a long
absence.
Time. It's been a long time.
And joining us today is a very special guest, a former co-host of this podcast, Patrick Miller. Good to have you back, sir.
Hey guys, glad to be on this podcast again.
Tyler
stole my thunder. I think he did that.
Stealing my line.
As always. All right. Jumping right back into the old banter. I love it.
Yeah, good to be back.
Piggybacking on my fame.
All right, well, if you guys are just joining us for the first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, Tyler, I believe you have the character name game for us this week.
Oh yeah.
All right, let's
hear it. Might take a while for you to guess it. Maybe, I don't know, maybe you're a huge fan of this guy or girl. Character's name for this week is Turner Lucas. Turner Lucas.
All right, so we'll come back and try to guess that at the very end. Normally we would transition into the media consume section. We'll save that for the end. Pat's got to take off here in the next few minutes. So we're going to jump right into our review of Die Hard.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home, Sue?
Well, we'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McClane, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
As they are ruthless.
But I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay.
We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McClane wants.
Think, damn it, think.
Is to be a hero.
Where's Holly?
Hey, Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
Job.
Alright, so Die Hard came out in 1988. It was directed by John McTiernan and stars Bruce Willis and a couple other people of no importance, with the exception of Alan Rickman. Let's
Carl
go ahead
Winslow.
And just, let's go. What'd you say, Tyler?
And Carl Winslow.
Of course, yeah.
Come on, dude.
Reginald Vell Johnson.
Vell Johnson.
Yeah, all right, so let's
go
around.
Days go bad.
Oh, well, all right.
I miss this stuff.
I assume, and this is my theory, that Carl Winslow is Carl Winslow in all of these movies that he plays a cop in.
Uh-huh.
And that you don't notice it from an episode of Family Matters, but like Carl Winslow has a detailed, action-filled history. But enough on that.
Okay. All right, well, let's go around the circle and just do some introductory thoughts on... let's keep it just to this movie for right now, so just the first Die Hard. Pat, let's start with you. What did you think about this movie?
Well, this was, I'm pretty sure, my first time seeing it all the way through. I'd only caught bits and pieces here and there, which is, you know, kind of pathetic, I know. But, you know, I enjoyed it. I can see how it's got a large fan base, and yeah, it's good action, good one-liners. It was more like refreshing one-liners rather than like the Arnold ones that are just sort of over the top ridiculous. These had some sort of basis in reality, if you can call it that. But
yeah,
I had a fun time watching it.
All right, Tyler, how about you?
Well, you know, I'm always looking for a Christmas movie that gets rid of like the warm themes, the cuddly themes, and replaces it with like glass in your bare feet, dirty talking Germans, and like C4 explosions. So Die Hard really hit a holiday nerve with me.
Nice.
And if you haven't seen it, and you know, you've got like, I don't know, Here Comes Santa Claus, the Claymation special in your DVD, replace it with Die Hard immediately.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is one of my favorite non-traditional Christmas movies. I've been, over the past few years, trying to watch it every Christmas season. And it's one of the more classic action movies ever made, and spawned a ton of not only sequels in its own franchise, but also kind of copycat movies like Die Hard on a bus, like Speed, or Die Hard in a hockey rink, like what's that movie that you love, Tyler, with Jean-Claude Van Damme?
Oh, Sudden Death, bitch.
Sudden Death, yeah. And, you know, other such things. So it clearly had influence over the genre. I love it. It's like one of my favorite action movies of all time. And the main reason for that is just everything about it. Like, it's perfect storytelling all the way through, I think. Nothing is there that doesn't need to be there, and even little one-liners and side conversations come back to be really important things later on in this movie. So I love the structure of it almost as much as the movie as a whole. So so do you want to, let's see, what do you think, Pat? Do you want to talk about like some favorite parts or parts that stuck out to you maybe? Especially, I mean, being your first viewing.
Yeah, yeah.
First full viewing all the way through. What kind of stuck out to you, either good or bad?
There are some ridiculous things that happen in this movie. None of them really come to mind. A lot of them, I guess, have to do with Reginald Val Johnson. I don't know, like the guy landing on his car. I don't know. Those aren't necessarily as ridiculous as maybe I'm just thinking second movie. I think that's what it is. I'm thinking I'm jumping ahead of myself here.
Die Hard 1's got some pretty intense moments.
Yeah, yeah. I think every time John McClane and Alan Rickman get together, I think those are my favorite moments of the film, because I think they just play so well off each other. Because Alan Rickman's just kind of a snob, like he's hateable.
Yeah.
And John McClane's just kind of a ruffian, and the juxtaposition of the two works well.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier, like, it has kind of a basis in reality. I think that's where we can open up the conversation a little bit if you guys want to start talking some about the sequels. But I think that's where this movie succeeds, where the other ones fail, is that this one, more than any other in the Die Hard franchise, is definitely the most based in, like, a real-world kind of scenario. And you've got it, and I think that's because it's such a self-contained story. I mean, like, Nakatomi Plaza is practically a character in the movie, and you get to know the geography of it. Like, he runs through different hallways, and, you know, he runs through the same areas over and over again, and you get a really great sense of, like, where he is and what exactly he's doing. Even though it's a really big building, he's only in a certain number of spots, and we as the audience become, like, intensely familiar with these places, so we kind of can see where he's going and know what he's doing, and it's not really confusing or anything. And yeah, even the moments like where the guy falls onto Reginald Val Johnson, was Al Powell, onto his car, and he like backs up. I mean, yeah, there are definitely some ridiculous aspects of it, but as far as the rest of the series goes, I think this one stays most true to life. What do you think, Tyler?
I don't know. Die Hard 2 is pretty realistic. I think
you're out of your mind.
And yeah, I mean, no, I think actually, now that you brought it up, Die Hard 1's a little out far-fetched, especially with that explosion in the basement or at the lower floor, and how the building didn't come crashing down.
Yeah,
like it was pretty irresponsible of McClane to set that off right at the base of the building, because you don't know how structural that thing is. I mean, you could have like tin foil, rye bar or whatever holding that thing up, and just blow it to bits isn't a great idea, especially when you have everybody at the top.
Yeah.
I mean, blowing up the top's one thing, but blowing down the basement and or wherever he was. Not a great strategy move.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to nitpick, there are a couple things, like the radios, the way that the radios worked in this movie didn't really make a ton of sense to me, because, like, McClane could communicate with Al Powell on an outside channel, but also with Hans Gruber through the same radio seemingly without switching channels, and maybe they could hear Hans Gruber sometimes, but they couldn't other times because he was, like, giving orders to his own people on the same frequency. There was a lot of, like, weird stuff where... Also, like, McClane would interrupt people on a CB radio, CB radio, which you can't do. If somebody's holding down the button, you can't talk over them.
I think that's legit, though. I think that... when we were kids, that's how walkie-talkies worked. Like, you could have, like... three sets of walkie-talkies all on the same channel, and they would all be able to communicate with me. And I think when McClane was talking to Carl Winslow, I think Gruber knew what they were saying. That's why they wouldn't really say anything, like, plan-wise. They'd just be like, oh, yeah, what's your kid's like? What's your kid like? Or blah, blah, blah. Like, Gruber's just like, fuck this shit. I'm not listening to this.
Well, I just mean, like, the cops outside would presumably be able to hear what Gruber was telling his own people, you know?
Sure.
If they were on that same frequency and be able to have some sort of insight into their plans. But yeah, I mean, as far as nitpicks go, that's about as far as I can go with this movie. Also, the one other thing that I point out to Pat was when, I don't know if you remember, Tyler, McClane is, he puts his, like, some sort of submachine gun or something between an elevator shaft, and he's, like, sliding down on the strap, and he is in the big elevator shaft and tries to, like, jump across, but ends up falling and then just catching onto a hole in the shaft, like, 10 or 12 feet below, just by his fingertips, basically, on this metal thing. Like, there's no way that a human body is capable of that.
But it's John McClane.
Right, but I think that's where, you know, I think "but it's John McClane" is a fair point for the later movies, because he becomes more of a superhero as the whole series progresses. But here, I think the main reason that Die Hard kind of separated itself from a lot of these other movies, especially in 88 when it came out, it was because he was just a regular guy. I mean, you had Schwarzenegger, you had Stallone, these huge jacked guys who were getting more and more ridiculous and buff as things were going. I mean, Rambo 3, for God's sake, he takes out, like, almost the entirety of Iraq just by himself.
Don't ruin it for me.
So you've got, you know, that in the pop culture zeitgeist at the time, and then you just switch it over to this one guy having to kind of take care of things himself, and he's just a normal dude. It's not like he doesn't have any sort of special scenario. He's just like a regular cop. So that's why I like the movie a lot. I think that's why it kind of, you know, made its mark in pop culture so much.
He might have gone into shock after the whole ordeal, because he probably broke a few bones, and with the adrenaline pumping, you don't feel that kind of stuff. And
yeah,
once he calms down, he's probably going to have, like, major surgery afterwards.
Yeah,
he probably like busted his knuckles or clinging onto that ventilation shaft, or, you know, popped his shoulder out or something. But
yeah,
at the time it didn't show, but X-rays showed later that he was severely damaged.
I like your it's like Die Hard fan fiction, like the in between, like Die Hard 1.5 or something.
Die Hard 1.5, the hospital visit.
I did like you guys kind of touched on a little bit. One of the other things I liked about the movie was just sort of maneuvering in this building, because, you know, you think you're in a building, you know. I work in a large skyscraper like that. You just think, oh, I'll take the elevator. That's A to B. That's how you get from one place to the other. But he can't necessarily use that simple method of travel. He's got to go, like, you know, A to C to get to B, you know? And it's just sort of like a puzzle how he kind of figures out if he wants to get to this floor or like a higher or a lower floor. And, you know, in such a confined space – or it brought, like, a complexity to, like, a more confined space.
Yeah, you know? Totally. And there's, like, they set it up really well, and that's what I'm talking about. This whole movie is, like, storytelling 101 with the way that they kind of set everything up so well in the very beginning. He walks into Nakatomi Plaza when McClane first gets there and says, like, oh, you know, you got a nice place. He's talking to, I think it's Takagi at the time, and he's like, yeah, it will be if we ever get it finished. There's still 7 floors under construction. And you think that's just kind of a one-off line that doesn't really – that's just, you know, making conversation. But that turns into a you know, a massively important plot point as the movie goes on. Another thing is, like, the whole fists with your toes thing, like the opening lines of the movie with McClane on the plane. That obviously comes back in a big way when he's – after he's kind of stressed out with this little tiff he's had with Holly in the office, and he takes his shoes off, and then Gruber and the rest of the dudes come busting in, and he's stuck with the rest of the movie without shoes. So, I mean, there's a lot of things like that that it does really well, just kind of setting up and paying off down the road. I think, you know, there's not much better when it comes to storytelling like that than Die Hard, I think. Pretty much everything.
Except maybe Die Hard 2.
We'll get to that. Tyler, you mentioned Hans Gruber. What did you think about – I know you're a big fan of Alan Rickman. What did you think about him in this movie and the character of Hans Gruber as a villain?
I mean, he had his crazy points. I mean, he looks pretty like he's got an agenda at the beginning, but then it turns out he really doesn't. He's just kind of as desperate as anybody else would be in that situation, which is kind of cool. But he is fairly villainous throughout the whole film. Like, he's not one of those characters that you're like, oh, I kind of feel sorry for him. Although, at some points, you do root for him just because, like, their story is almost as important as McClane's, which is kind of cool. Like, you really kind of sometimes don't see that. So you're kind of like, oh, yeah, like the scene where they opened the vault. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, they got it. Like, you know, it's just some real, you know, big corporation's money. I mean, really, who are they hurting? And then you're like, oh, wait, everyone. So, I mean, that part was and like Rickman, he always delivers kind of this, not the same performance, but a good performance, because I guess the way he talks and the way he delivers lines and the way he's like almost maniacal whenever he says stuff. And then and then if he gets pissed off, then things are really going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, he's like the epitome of 80s slickness here. Yeah. You know, he's got the suits and everything, and just, like, everything is really slick about him. And it's almost as, like, I think his name was Ellis, that kind of sleazy co-worker of Holly's, is talking about how he, like, negotiates million-dollar deals for breakfast and stuff. It's like, he is essentially Hans Gruber's character, but... or the character of Hans Gruber, but just not violent, really. I mean, it's like they really show that kind of that parallel to, like, corporate whatever greed and kind of that kind of business slickness that you have to have to survive in this kind of shark infested waters of a corporate world with what Hans Gruber does. And I like how people keep claiming that he's just a common thief, you know, throughout the movie. And yeah, I mean, it's all about money. That's what most of these kind of villains are really all about anyway. But he just comes off as, like, this really sophisticated dude. So I think, I don't know, he's one of my favorite villains in an action movie. Because a lot of times these guys are just, you know, people who are soldiers from another country, like in the second one. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit later, but, you know, just guys that are, that don't really have a ton of personality, don't really have a ton of motivation for what they're doing other than just money or whatever. And even though Hans Gruber doesn't have a ton of motivation that we're privy to, it's still, he's still fun to watch. He still has a lot of personality to him. So
yeah.
Well, my favorite line of his is when she goes, oh, you're just, well, when Holly goes, you're just a common thief. And he, like, rushes over to her, like speed crawls over to her and, like, looks her right in the face. He's like, no, I'm an exceptional thief. And I'm like, you know what? You're right, dude. You went through a lot of work to get all this done, and it's paying off so far. As the next set of events take unfold, it start to feel bad for old Gruber.
Yeah, and actually that was another thing. At the end of the movie, Holly's watch, the Rolex, comes into play. That's not really anything that I picked up on in previous times watching this film, but I noticed it this time.
Popcorn's done.
Popcorn, that's what we're doing. So you've got, like, Ellis talks about right when he meets McClane for the first time, he's like, oh yeah, take a look at the watch, like, come on, it's a Rolex, it's awesome. And then that's what Hans is grabbing onto at the very end, and McClane, in this kind of huge bit of symbolism, shatters this Rolex and saves Holly's life. So there's a lot of cool stuff like that, and I think McClane as a character, I mean, this entire story is just this big anti-authoritarian or authoritative thing where it's like the government is completely inept in this situation. I mean, you've got the cops, and Powell is the only one who's like this street cop or not even a street cop, he's a desk cop who doesn't even do this kind of stuff on a regular basis, and he's the only one who has any sort of common sense. And his boss, who's the guy who played the principal in The Breakfast Club, is just like a total asshat. Like, he does nothing, and she shoots down every sort of common sense suggestion that Powell gives them throughout the whole movie, and just runs the terrorist playbook right there, you know, page by page, like they're talking about. So
yeah, that was the funny part of that. I was surprised that they went that far as not insulting the government, but basically just kind of saying, sometimes this is what happens. And then like those FBI agents show up, and they're like, they're just like complete retards when it comes to doing their job, because you know, they don't think ahead like Gruber did, where he's like, I know exactly what the FBI is going to do. Like, that's all them coming in is all part of my plan. And the FBI agents are just like, yeah, he doesn't know. Like, was it the second one or the first one? No, it was the first one where they, I can't remember, but somebody calls them and does something, and they're like, oh, I bet they're pissing their pants right now.
Yeah.
Is that the first one?
Yeah, that's the first one.
Yeah.
I can't remember what he had called them about.
Said, they turned the power off.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
They shut down the power to Nakatomi Plaza. And
it helps them unlock the vault. And the guy down there is like, oh, I bet they're pissing their pants right now. And these guys are like, oh, yeah.
And that's so, like the same thing with the news. Like, they cut to the news and they've got that specialist who wrote that book, like, hostage terrorist hostage. Right. And he's like talking about how, yeah, I'm sure the hostages are going through the first stage of the Helsinki syndrome right now. And they're pulling out like Ellis's dead body, like cutting that back and forth, like just proving that these people have no idea what they're talking about in real way that it's going down.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, the captives start to form a dependent relationship on the captors and vice versa. And then, yeah, Ellis gets shot in the head.
Yeah.
He's like, you're useless. Yeah, John McClane is an awesome character because he's borderline insane. I mean, let's just say it. I mean, he's talking to himself constantly. He's answering himself constantly. And, I mean, we all do that, seriously, especially in these types of situations. But in movies, you usually don't see that. But I guess that is kind of a sense of realism because he is borderline crazy. and I'm surprised he could go back into society after this movie and then the next three. Hopefully four.
Yeah, I think he's coming back for the next one.
Without getting a straitjacket at the end of every movie.
Right.
Although he might have been institutionalized between Die Hard 3 and Live Free or Die Hard. We don't know.
We'll have to read your fan fiction to find out.
That could have led to the end of his marriage with Holly, because I don't think she was in the fourth one.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's definitely separated from her in that one.
I'm really hoping that Argyle comes back in the next one, because he was kind of awesome. I love that character.
Like, he owns a limousine company now.
Yeah.
Oh, John, hey, how's it going? You need a limo? Here's one.
I gotta stick around for New Year's.
Like, and Christmas and Hollis is still playing. Like, that's, like, in his commercials for the limousine company.
Yeah.
Creating this whole new universe.
Yeah, something interesting that I learned not too long ago is that Nakatomi Plaza is actually the Fox Plaza. It's the headquarters for 20th Century Fox, and the building was actually under construction when they were filming Die Hard. So they used their own building to make their own movie in it. James Rocky, who's one of the well-respected movie writers, hopefully we'll have him on the podcast one of these days, talks about this on the AV Club. So if you guys go to – I'll put the link in the show notes. But if you go to the AV Club and search for their Pop Pilgrims videos, he talks about Nakatomi Plaza and the history of that the building and the movie and stuff like that. It's really interesting. So
that probably saved them a lot of dough. Like, they're like, okay, we're trying to make this movie.
Yeah, totally.
And basically, he's going to destroy huge portions of a skyscraper. Anybody want to anybody want to lend us their building? And everyone's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to use our own.
Yeah, and it helped out a lot with like the construction and stuff that was actually going on. I mean, they probably didn't even have to do too much to make those sets and stuff. It's like they could just stop their construction, film what they need to for a little while, and then move on.
Right, but then the construction workers come back Monday morning, and they're just like, WTF, guys. Like, why is there fake blood everywhere? Gotta clean this up.
Yeah.
Also part of the fan fiction.
And then another kind of behind-the-scenes thing to mention, I noticed that Jan DeBont, who was the director of photography for this movie, and he went on to direct Speed, Speed 2, Cruise Control, Twister, and Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life. So,
wait, is it called Cruise Control, Speed 2?
Yeah, Speed 2, colon, Cruise Control.
Isn't that on a boat?
It is, yeah.
That's so many levels. Like cruise, but it also means like, oh man.
It would have been better if they got Tom Cruise to star in it, I think.
Do boats even have cruise control? Like, that's my question. Like, can the captain just be like, all right, hold steady.
Save it, Tyler. Save it for our speed duology episode.
Tom Cruise.
They call it
fan fiction. Speed 3. Keep it cruising.
Keep it cruising. All right. So, is there anything else in the first Die Hard that you guys wanted to get to that we didn't really touch on, Pat? Anything?
You know, it's just kind of cool being out here in LA, seeing that stuff in real life. You know, I think they have multiple shots of Avenue of the Stars, which is, you know, one of my favorite scenic places out in LA. So yeah. Just on a personal note, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and
kind of stuff happen all the time out there. Is that what he's saying?
What?
Do like skyscraper hijackings happen all the time out there?
You never know, Tyler.
There actually was a random shooting in Hollywood about a mile from where we live, like 2 days ago, where this guy just pulled out a gun and started shooting random people and cars as they were passing by. So, I mean, yeah, it's not unheard of that crazy stuff like that goes down in this
section. That sounds totally Carl, man. Carl, okay.
But yeah, just what you're talking about, the kind of personal note, frequent guest of this podcast, Allison Loring from FilmSchoolRejects.com now. She and I play tennis in Century City, kind of in the shadow of the Nakatomi building. So that's kind of cool that that's like, you know, yeah, it's a regular part of Los Angeles life out here. So it's kind of cool.
Is that what it's really called, or is it called the Fox Building?
No, it's called the Fox Plaza, but everybody always calls it the Nakatomi Building. I mean, come on. Why would
I call it that? I'd call it that too.
Yeah. So anything that you wanted to cover, Tyler, in this first one we can get to?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple levels that like notch it up. I mean, it's a good movie, but then you put Christmas behind it and then you add Carl Winslow and it's like, it's one of those movies that you're like, okay, it'd be good if it was missing all those variables, but then you add them and you're like, oh man, it's better than I thought. And it is one of those movies. Like you said, there are very few movies that I watch over and over again. Like once I see a movie, I'm like, okay, I've seen it. I can talk about it really.
Yeah.
But there are a select few movies, maybe top, maybe like 10, maybe 15 movies that I watch like every year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I would consider Die Hard one of those.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
With Trancers?
Well, Trancers 2 was actually better. So.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you got to watch both of them to get the whole saga. So yeah. Every year, man.
Both of the Trancers movies or both of the Die Hards?
Well, I watch Trancers, then Die Hard 2, then Die Hard 1, then Trancers 2.
Oh, man. All right. Okay, so with that, I think Pat has to take off here. So why don't you tell people where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
No problem. As always, you can find me on the-life-after.blogspot.com, bringing it back.
And you can...
Oh, I haven't heard that in so long.
You've done something recent, too. Why don't you tell people about
your most recent... If you want to take a look, my brother and I were lucky enough to go to Ibiza, Spain. And, I made an episode for The Life After involving that trip. So, you know, if you want to check that out, feel free. It's on Life After.
You know where to go.
You know where to go.
Yeah, you went to Club Island, I think, is what you referred to it as.
Club Island. I don't think I ever referred to it as that, but
you're like, it's 24/7 club atmosphere.
Yep. I mean, yeah,
strobe lights instead of street lights.
It was mayhem. We could have made it crazier than we did, but you know, we had to keep it PG for the viewers.
Yeah,
all the grandmas out there.
And there's a side trip to Barcelona involved. So, yeah, I'm not going to spoil everything, but you people should probably go check that out. It's just a few minutes.
Everyone knows the P in VIP stands for Pat.
Very important, Pat.
There you go.
Awesome. All right, man. Well, thanks for joining us. Good having you back.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
All right. So, with that, let's go ahead and talk about Die Hard 2, Die Harder. That's actually what it's called.
I know, but it's just the way you say it. Whenever you say those titles, but if the titles are comical and when you say it, it's pretty funny.
All right.
Die Harder.
You're the wrong guy in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Story of my life.
They say lightning doesn't strike twice.
That's how I spent Christmas last year.
They were wrong.
McLean, is this what you were expecting?
No, this is just the beginning.
Bruce Willis, Die Hard 2. Die Harder.
Die Hard 2, Die Harder came out in 1990. This film was directed by Rennie Harlan. And,
boy,
has got Bruce Willis reprising his role as Lieutenant John McClane. So, Tyler, I know in the last episode you talked about how you were going to make the assertion that Die Hard 2 is the best of the series. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you still hold to that after rewatching it?
I do, actually.
Wow. Okay. All right. So let me talk a little bit about my thoughts on this movie, and then I'll let you kind of defend that thesis. So I am not a big fan of this one. I think because they open the scope up to a full airport and take things from the vertical to the horizontal, it really takes away a lot of the immediacy that was so well done and very present in the first movie. And this time it's like, okay, now McClane has got to trek under these tunnels and he's just got to run like miles and miles to get from one thing to another. There's a lot of like weird stuff going on with all these people up in the control tower that like, really, is that the main thrust of this movie? Like, we spend way too much time in that control tower, I feel like. And McClane is fine. He seems a little bit more ridiculous in this one. He seems more willing to kind of shout things and like, whoa, look at that. Oh, holy crap. Wow. And like almost commentating on what's happening to him more so than the first one.
And that's not a highlight for you?
Not so much, no. And then,
I don't even know you, dude.
And the explosion.
I'm leaving. I'm walking away.
There's multiple plane crashes, or I guess just the one. No, there's multiple.
Yeah, there's multiple. Yeah.
And both of them feature explosions that are at least 50 or 60 times bigger than what a normal plane crash should look like, I think. And that may be
credentials for making a good movie.
That may be just because it's a product of 1990. But even so, I don't know. Let's hear your
first year of the decade, and it's setting the standard, I guess.
Yeah.
Since it's 1990, not like, you know, later 90s, right. A Van Damme film with explosions. But yeah, I mean, seriously, if you know me at all, Ben, which you do, you know that this is going to fit very nicely onto my little shelf of, you know, one of the best explosive movies ever made. I mean, Die Hard's good, and I'm going to give it that. I mean, I really like Die Hard. But Die Hard 2 is a good companion piece to Die Hard, because it's like, okay, Die Hard was good storytelling, but I wish there were more explosions and maybe a more ridiculous John McClane. Like, you start to – and I can tell where the writers went with this, because they're like – like you said, you know, John McClane kind of becomes a superhero, you know, as the series unfolds. And so let's say you have the writers of Die Hard 1 and you're like, okay, what are we going to do? Like, we can't rehash the same movie again if we're going to make a new one. John McClane's this badass who, like, has these good one-liners, and he's kind of insane. The idea of, like, putting McClane into any one of these ridiculous situations, I think, is kind of what they were going for. And, like you said, moving from the vertical to the horizontal, I mean, that seems like a logical... And then, like, the third one, they can move to the diagonal. You know, like, it just seems like a logical thing. Like, he doesn't want to be in a skyscraper anymore, so clearly, like, the airport, where its expansive size is going to add to the suspense of the film. And I think the suspense is added into the whole tower sequences, because you have McClane running around, like, pissing off everybody, but then you also have these separate stories going on where it's like, what's going on with the drug dealer or whoever, like the Colombian general,
mm-hmm.
and these other guys, and then there's this guy who isn't Joe Don Baker, who I thought was for sure was Joe Don Baker, but it wasn't him. And the guy that for a second I thought was Ving Rhames, but then I had to remember what Ving Rhames looked like, and that wasn't Ving Rhames either. So, and then you have kind of this idea, like the Barnes character, the guy that is kind of in control. He's like the smartest guy in the tower. Like, that's an interesting character too, and it's very layered. And I think that's maybe a lot of people are turned off by that, especially when you want to tune into an action movie. You want to see like just one line, like one linear plot.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of things going on in this movie, and like the action, there's a variety of action. It's not just like, you know, McClane like just doing karate or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has to defeat these guys in differing ways because the airport allows for like differing environments of firefights and things like that. Like in the Nakatomi Power, like, he was, you know, he kind of had his shit ready, like settled, because like every floor kind of looked the same, or he was on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
At the airport, he's either like outside in the snow or in the basement with those tunnels, or he's, you know, in these luggage like machine thing with the mm-hmm. the moving And that's weird, because you never think of what is inside an airport as far as a civilian goes, because you just put your luggage into like a door that, and then it disappears, and you're like, I guess it's magic.
Yeah.
But in reality, there's like this intricate like system of what do they call it? Like rolling.
Yeah,
floors.
Like baggage claim type of stuff. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the contraption though. Like it's
Yeah, I can't think of the name.
Like where you put your groceries on it.
Like a
like the thing, and it moves, and it puts the groceries closer to the cashier.
Right. Yeah, I think everybody knows.
It's
what you're
like
talking
a roller.
About.
It's kind of like a rolling thing.
Right. And, yeah.
It's got. There's a word for it.
Yeah.
And the machine's called something, but
maybe
anyway.
It'll come to us later. But
yeah. But that, I think that's why I really like Die Hard 2, because it pushes the ridiculous factor. It doesn't really go too far, but it goes just far enough to kind of be, okay, that was pretty cool, but not saying, okay, that's completely outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of pushes that envelope there, but there's a lot of variety in it. McClane's better than ever, and, you know, it's just McClane in another situation. I mean, you can't really knock it for that.
Man, I don't know. I think because okay, you talked about you thought
I should have won you over, Ben. Clearly, that was an elongated speech to win you over to this side.
It was passionate and well informed. I'll give you that, but it doesn't necessarily change my full view of the movie. I mean, I think you know, you talked about like the horizontal versus the vertical and stuff like that, and I think you know
that
the whole.
You.
Well, I know, but the whole point of this movie is to like increase the scope, right? And that's actually what the franchise has done throughout its history. Is it start out in this one building, then it goes to an airport in the second one, then it goes to New York City in the third one, and then it goes to the United States in the fourth one, and now they're going global for this fifth one that is going to be called A Good Day to Die Hard. Yeah.
Tokyo.
So
Tokyo.
The problem with that to me is that it's like they're missing the point by increasing the scope. They're missing the point of what made the first one so good, and that was because it was in this confined space. I think being really intensely familiar with the landscape and the geography of Nakatomi Plaza is a huge advantage for that movie, whereas here they're kind of
going around, and yeah, you got a bunch of people like Marv the janitor and all these other people who kind of come in and help McClane because the landscape is so much bigger than he's used to handling. You've got, you know, like you mentioned, Barnes, who is a great character, the communications director of the airport, and some of these other guys, but then it just seems like because the place is so big and so kind of impersonal, the airport doesn't really feel like a character to me as much as Nakatomi Plaza does in the first one, where it's got these, you know, these really light areas where they're doing the party and it's really kind of, you know, sleek and corporate and whatever. And then you've got the more like the bowels of it where Argyle is down there in the parking garage. And then you've got these areas where like smoke is shooting through hallways and they've got the computer system set up and everything. So there's a lot of personality to that building. And I feel like the airport has no personality. It's just kind of a bland landscape where McClane happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I don't know, the villains and stuff in the first one, because they're just after money, everything's very simple. Like in the end of Die Hard 1, or I guess it's not the end, you know, near the end of Die Hard 1, Hans Gruber talks to the FBI and he requests that all these people be released from these different prisons, right, across the world. Right. And he's just like naming off all these factions and stuff. And even one of his own guys kind of looks at him quizzically, and Gruber's like, oh, I read about him in Time magazine. Like, he doesn't care about these people that he's asking to be released. Right. He's just doing it for distraction. And Die Hard 2, it seems like the stuff that's a joke in Die Hard 1 is actually the real plot of Die Hard 2. Right. It's like you've got General Esperanza and these, you know, Colombian drug lords and stuff. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if it was just me or if it wasn't very clear, but what exactly was the end goal of Colonel Stewart and Esperanza? Like, did you get anything from that? Like, what were they trying to do?
I think what they were trying to do is he had been arrested, the general,
mm-hmm.
and coming into the United States. And then these guys were going to get him back on a plane to Colombia, basically to escape again. So he took this long flight from Colombia to Washington, D.C., and then the whole goal was to get him back on a plane to go back to Colombia.
Okay.
And be, I think, I don't know, I wasn't really worried about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I kind of want to worry about that.
I was just waiting for the big finale, Ben.
Because it's like, I don't know, I can't necessarily get behind, you know, you mentioned like it's really easy to get behind Hans Gruber because you realize what his motivations are. You realize that he is an exceptional thief and he has this really intricate planning system and kind of thinks of every possibility. And that makes him interesting as a character. It makes you kind of root for him, even though he is the bad guy. And here it's like, sure. Because they're, if that's really their plan, what you just said, then why don't, like, it doesn't seem like it's that, it would be that difficult for the U.S. to go back into Colombia and just capture him again and put him back on another plane. You know, it just seems like a never ending back and forth. So I don't know, for some reason, even though I'm sure a lot more lives were at stake this time, it seemed to me like the stakes weren't quite as high in Die Hard 2. So, I don't know, just from a storytelling standpoint, it didn't really have the same impact that the first one did for me. There was some cool action scenes and stuff like that in it, but it just didn't, none of it really resonated with me the same way that the first one did. Let's talk about William Atherton, who plays Richard Dick Thornburg, the journalist. Oh, yeah. From the first movie, who we didn't mention.
That's your name, right?
Yeah, who reprises his role here. What did you think about him? And also, what did you think about the whole relationship with him and Holly on the plane as John is down in the airport?
Yeah, it took me a while, and I watched these a day in between. Like, I watched Die Hard 1 on Saturday, and I watched Die Hard 2 today on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a second to realize that that was the same guy from the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it took me, when Holly said I punched his teeth out, I was like, wait, when did that happen? Is she referring to something that happened? Oh, yeah, that's right. It happened right at the end of Die Hard.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, he's unlikable, and I'm glad that, although it was weird because, and that's another reason why I like that movie, and I'll talk about it in a second, so remind me.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, he's just as an unlikable a character, even though he's not really bad. But he's unlikable for different reasons. Like, at least the bad guys are, like, straight up bad. But this guy's, like, not doing great things, or he's doing not great things.
Yeah.
Whatever way you say it. But he's also viewed as, like, acceptable, like fear-mongering and things like that.
Yeah.
And
he's just like doing that, he's doing whatever he needs to get ratings, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, the whole kind of him on the plane, again, like, talking about other storylines in this movie, like, that's a whole nother happening up there. Like, what's going on in these planes and Holly and Dick kind of, you know, ideal, like, an idealistic adversaries, like, she's, you know, taking this one way and he's taking this story a different way. You know, she's worried about John, he's worried about his career, and kind of the dueling human behavior is kind of an interesting thing to look at.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to my point about the media and kind of how this could have been a realistic situation. I hope it never is, but kind of just this, like, when at the very beginning, when the guy's like, okay, we have 15,000 people in the airport, like, don't say anything to them because we're just going to create, like, chaos here. Mm-hmm. Like, let's deal with it as much as we can before we have to. Like, if they had tried to force people out, it would have created just sheer chaos, and it probably would have caused more damage than good. And these guys in the media, they're like waiting for stuff like that. They want that kind of stuff to happen, and it's kind of, that's a sad point in society, because that's kind of what fuels this kind of stuff today, where it's like, oh, you know, nothing's worth mentioning on Black Friday except for the fact that someone, like, mauled over someone.
Right.
You know, you can't just say, oh, you know, down at the Kohl's, like, there were some good deals. No, the report is someone, you know, got a cleaver in the neck because they were holding, like, a, I want to say a Power Rangers action figure. I think they're still buying those nowadays.
Sure, that seems like a popular toy for the kids.
Tickle Me Elmo, is that still huge? I don't know. But yeah, I mean, just kind of that. I mean, they made a comment, or they were trying to make commentary on the government in the first one. I think they were trying to make commentary on the media in this one. So I think there are some deeper levels to these movies than we give it credit for.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did both. I think they did the media and the government in both of them. I think, you know,
you've
got that same character doing essentially the same type of, like, sleazy reporting in the first one, which is why Holly punches him in the first place. He tries to get the kids and get them on camera and whatever. And then in here, the government would be like the people in the control tower, and especially Dennis Franz, who is like the airport main cop there, who is basically the same character as the guy who was the principal in the Breakfast Club in the first one, you know, like the Al Powell's commander.
Yeah, the guy from NYPD Blue.
Yeah. So he's like a total douche who doesn't listen to McClane, even though he clearly knows what he's talking about, and he's, like, super sarcastic with him and just very, you know, like, condescending and everything. And, you know, yeah, there's a lot. It must be, like, a product of the time that these movies were made and that people kind of needed that at the time. I don't know. You would probably know better than me, like, what the landscape of American politics was looking like in the late 80s, early 90s. And maybe people needed, you know, that kind of catharsis of, you know, having a representative on screen of, like, one guy being able to take care of business all by himself in the face of, you know, adversity of the government and all these people kind of stepping in and providing all these obstacles.
Well, I mean, you had the end of the Cold War in 1989, you know, the kind of the official end of the Cold War. We were coming out of Reaganomics. Reagan was this great president, and then, like, H.W. Bush wasn't this great president. You know, he was just kind of continuing Reagan's policies for the most part, but no one really liked him. Yeah, and I mean, the drug wars, you know, kind of the U.S.'s new thing was on drugs instead of communism. It was now drugs. So there's, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess people were just looking.
There seems to be a blend.
I was just giving you a lowdown on what was going on, say.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, yeah, taking that into consideration, there seems to be a blending of all of those things in this movie. You know, we've got the drug subplot with Esperanza, and you've got just the kind of, the, I don't know, like the shoehorning in of policies and stuff by this Dennis Franz's character, who just like is doing it by the book just because that's by the book and not necessarily why that's not necessarily reason enough for any sort of action on his part. But I don't know. I think you're right. I think there is a little bit more to these movies than people generally kind of give them credit for. But there's also, like, especially in this movie, like the whole double crossing with, what is his name? Grant or something. One of the main soldiers.
Bing Rames.
They've got the whole blue versus red clips that they put in, and
yeah,
it's, you know, it just like there's stuff that's just plain stupid in this movie. So I don't know.
I think that would have been kind of a shocker if you were going into theaters to see it for the first time. I think that would have been kind of a twist, because you have so much going on, and then all of a sudden this, and you're just like, whoa, what? What the hell is happening?
Yeah, but does it really make sense, like, that this guy would... I don't know, it just seems really convoluted and very, like, really in-depth for this plan, for this guy, Major Grant, to, like, go... it seems like a lot of trouble for the Special Forces to go through to trick people into thinking that they're on one side when they're actually on the other. It's like, these guys are trained soldiers. Why wouldn't they just... peace out, like go MIA or something, and then just work for these guys openly instead of like trying to go through the whole song and dance of convincing the airport security that they're on their side. Like, I don't know, it just, the whole thing just rang false to me.
I mean the airport was going to call the military or like whoever, the, you know, they're in Washington DC, so like the whole plan of them like placing a military or a faux military, like, what are those things called? Groups?
Yeah, like a faction or something.
Platoon, yeah. And, like, that's why McLean was like, well, you only sent us one platoon?
Yeah.
And that was because it's, like, a fake one. Like, the military probably would have sent more had they actually been contacted.
Right.
And the whole thing about, like, oh... and this was another where you're talking about how little things at the beginning kind of come back at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one where it was like someone had been replaced and they ended up like killing that guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of when you were like, oh, why are they doing that? Oh, okay, got it. Like you kind of just kind of realize it if you hadn't figured it out by that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, wait a second, fake Ving Rhames. Why are you doing that? Oh, I got it now. You're not Ving Rhames.
And then, so, let's talk
this
about...
this isn't Dawn of the Dead.
Let's talk about the big climax of this movie, which is McClane
somehow
knocking off the fuel hatch of this movie right after Grant
gets... he just pulls it open. He pulls it open,
sucked into the engine. And then...
right. Fake Ving Rhames there. So, oh, hell no!
So, basically, the plane is...
meet me somewhere!
Stop doing your Ving Rhames impression.
Give me an address!
So anyway, Ving Rhames, not Ving Rhames, dies in this thing. Right. And the plane is leaking all of this gas. And it goes for, I don't know, hundreds of yards, I would say, in a huge snowstorm with wind blowing everywhere and constant snow flurries. And McClane,
very heavy.
McClane lays on the ground, busts out a cigarette lighter, and drops the yippee-ki-yay. And throws the lighter down, and then fire catches on and follows hundreds of yards down this trail up to the plane, which has already taken off. Yes. Fire races into the air and then goes into the gas tank and blows it up in one of the more spectacular explosions of the early 90s, I would say.
Set the stage for what would be the 90s.
But it's like, I don't know, you're talking about, or we were talking about earlier, the realism of the first one, and then you take something like that, where it's like, you've got all of this high winds and crazy weather and stuff, like, really, would that really be an unbroken stream of gas at that point? I don't know, I don't think
so. We need the guys from Mythbusters, and we could write this episode, like, the guys from Mythbusters just get a 747 somehow, I'm sure they're available to civilians, and test this theory, and I'm going to say it's going to actually work, because gasoline, you know, it can fume, and like the cloud of gas that had, you know, existed between the ground and the plane
Yeah.
That could have lit on fire, and I would think that it caught on fire faster. Like it caught on fire pretty fast, first of all,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's kind of where the variable of like, okay, this plane is going pretty fast. First of all, how is the fire going to be able to catch up with it? And it does, obviously.
Yeah.
But is that possible? I think that's kind of the thing that I didn't really believe was the speed of the. The chemical reaction, but yeah. I think overall the whole idea was pretty badass.
What did you think?
What he really should have done was like light the lighter as he jumped off the wing, and that still would have resulted in a pretty big explosion, but a more realistic one. Although he might have died.
Right. Yeah.
Although the plane was going though, he could have like the explosion could have sent him off, and then the plane. As yeah. it was still moving, like its momentum carried it away from McLean.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think he might have died if that had been the case. Of the possible endings, I think this one is the most logical.
Yeah, I can see that. There's a couple things that I wanted to mention as far as like ridiculousness. You know, we've talked a lot about that already with the Die Hard sure. 2 conversation, but a couple things that stuck out to me. The grenades being thrown into the cockpit of the plane yeah. and McLean pulling the ejector seat right as it explodes. Did that ring like an awesome bell for you, or was that more of like, wow, this is crazy?
Kind of. I mean, the ejector seat did. The length of time it took for those grenades to go off
yeah.
Was a little longer than I'm used to, because yeah, grenades exactly. generally like maybe 4 seconds.
Yeah, if I know anything from playing a Grand Theft Auto game, it is the timing of grenades, and that was not it. It was way longer.
And
in this
when
movie.
You toss them from the top of a building onto pedestrians, I mean, they got a good 3 seconds to run away, but they never make it.
Right.
These laid there like they were throwing like tens of them.
They were like cockpit. They were like, we've got three each. Throw
He's
them
like,
all.
Use them. Like one's not gonna do it. I mean, seriously, and one's gonna do it.
And also, that makes no sense because they all exploded at once, so they all would yeah. have had to pull all the pins at the same exact time and throw them all in at the same time, which they clearly didn't do. So there was that.
Yeah, they're just like they just pulled all the pins and like they're each holding like three armed grenades, and like they toss one at a time. Like, oh man, that is danger zone.
Yeah. And then
yeah, pulling the little after effect of him ejecting was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, it was like terrible.
Like, I'm in front of a camera.
Yeah. and then the gunshot in Esperanza's plane when it goes through the windshield, like they're thousands of feet above sea level. Have they ever heard of pressurization? I don't know. I'm pretty sure.
I think they sucked out.
Yeah, I don't know if – I think Mythbusters actually, speaking of them, did an episode on whether or not that would happen. I don't remember what the outcome was, but yeah, I'm pretty sure
– Huh? Did the guy with the beret die?
No, not that I know of.
Oh, Francois, no!
I hope he hears this. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that would F you up in some way, at least like burst your eardrums or something. And it seemed to have very little effect on Esperanza. That's pretty much it. We're just going to be treading the same ground over and over again with this.
Two awesome films, Ben. Glad you suggested it.
I'm glad the Apple II pulled it up for us. A little bit more glad about the first one than the second, but yeah. So, let's
no, we're watching it again while you're home for break. I'm bringing Die Hard 2 over.
Oh Lord, I will conveniently be gone today.
You know, we're watching. We're actually going to do a double feature, and I'm going to call it Die Hard 2 Towers, and we're gonna pair the two up.
Of Die Hard
and the Two Towers.
Okay, the Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
Yeah, get it, dude. Come on.
I got you.
After that, but I couldn't think of anything that melded Die Harder with a Tolkien reference.
Lord of the Rings. I don't know. Yeah, I can't do it either.
Heart of the Rings.
Okay. All right. So let's go ahead and pull the Apple II and let people know what we're going to be watching next week.
Yeah, definitely. Let me pull that lever. All right, we'll be watching BKO, Bangkok Knockout, which is not a porno, presumably.
Okay, that movie is available on Netflix Watch Instantly. So if you guys want to watch along, shoot us an email. Let us know what you think of it. You can email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566.
Hey, do we have any of those this week?
Yeah, we actually do. So if you guys call and leave us a voicemail, you might sound something like this.
Hey, fellas. Just calling the show. Love the content, and I heard you guys are going to talk about Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 2. First point, I'm pretty insulted as a Die Hard 3 fan, or Die Hard with a Vengeance, as I call it. You're not including that in the stethoscope of what you guys are discussing tonight. Because clearly that's the best one, and then that one with Justin Long, that one was okay too, but I could excuse that because that came like 20 years later. Second point, I love the Die Hard franchise. Just wanted to get that out there, and I think these movies should be remade in about 20 years, but who do you think should be the lead actor when it happens? Or maybe if this happens in like 5 to 10, maybe like a Timothy Oliphant? I don't know. I want to hear your take. Love the show, guys.
All right. Well, thanks for the voicemail there. I think that was our good friend Joe. So if anybody wants to leave a voicemail, just leave us your name and maybe where you're from or something like that so we know who we're talking to here. Big fan of the Die Hard series. I like it. I'm glad that that Joe appreciates it. Although the third one, Tyler, we didn't really talk about that. What do you think about Die Hard with a Vengeance, the Samuel L. Jackson third entry in this franchise?
Third one's pretty bad. I don't remember a lot from it. And probably offending Joe many different ways right now, but I'm sorry. Samuel L. Jackson can only do so much.
Okay.
I think it involves like public schools and like a sewer system.
Yep.
And Gruber's brother.
Yep.
Like it's pretty intense, and it's in Harlem, so there's that too.
Yeah.
So that's not really expanding. I guess. Oh, maybe the whole city. Maybe that's the expansion there. Okay.
It's a big New York thing, but I'll side with Joe on this one because I like Die Hard with a Vengeance a lot more than Die Hard 2. I won't say that it's the best one of the series because I don't agree with that, but. That's kind of an interesting point. A remake, I mean, with the way Hollywood's going these days, I wouldn't be surprised if they remade it in, 5 or 10 years. So, Tyler, who do you think you would like to see as the lead, as the new John McClane, if they were to do something like that?
Now, so we're doing fantasy casting or who they'll actually cast as
Maybe a little bit of both, if you have it in you.
He said Timmy Oliphant, which I call him because we're personal friends.
Right.
Timmy O, sometimes I call him that. That would be a good one.
But that makes no sense because he played the villain in Die Hard 4.
That's a good point, Ben. I'm glad you reminded us of that because I had kind of skipped over that little facet of info. But you never know. Maybe he was cloned or, we have seen people come back, especially in the Bond series. You saw
rebooted.
Well, if you go and look at You Only Live Twice, he befriends somebody who ends up being Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever. So the same actor, different roles.
Okay.
Same universe because it was both Connery film. They were both Connery films.
Yeah.
So, you could do that kind of stuff. Who I would pick, who would you go with?
I mean, I think Hollywood would probably pick somebody like Taylor Lautner to do it in the next few years.
Yeah, that's the shitty path I was talking about.
Right. If I had my own...
Christian or Hayden Christensen or what's Sam Worthington or some of these douchebags that are making way too much money because their talent really doesn't measure up to, I don't know how much to make, $1,000 maybe?
Yeah.
How much you get for a movie nowadays?
Something like that. $1,000 sounds about right.
I don't know, maybe is freaking Liam Neeson too old nowadays?
I think Liam Neeson is way older than McClane was in the first
one. I don't know, that would be a cool little tweak on the story.
Yeah, I like it.
It wouldn't be John McClane, but
Maybe
I think Bruce Willis should just play the character until he dies, and so we. I think it would be unholy for anyone to take. Like, it would be like Indiana Jones being someone else being Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely. Being,
you know, I don't know. Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an iconic character. I think the respect should probably be shown to it. I think it would be interesting to see Liam Neeson maybe in like a prequel playing John McClane's father or something, but the same type of stuff happens to him, so it could be kind of like The Thing was that came out this year, you know, like a prequel and a remake kind of at the same time. That would be interesting.
Yeah, we could. And there just isn't, like, I'm sure, yeah, like you're saying, I mean, we should honor it, but Hollywood, we're talking about Hollywood here, so anything going against honor is probably what they'll do. So they'll probably remake it. They'll probably replace it with someone British, you know, like they're doing with all our superhero movies.
Like Tom Hardy.
Yeah, or who's the guy playing Spider-Man? Like, that would be someone that we would actually see in a Die Hard movie.
Andrew Garfield, yeah.
Yeah, we would not see the people that we have seen in, like, the 80s and 90s.
Right.
Maybe Van Damme should take it on. I mean, he's not that old. He's what, like, 55?
56? Sure. Yeah, we'll go with that.
I think he still does the high kick, the super kick.
All right, well, let's move on here. We've got a couple new Twitter followers this week. And that would be at Jared and Matthew, and at Faiza Gire, excuse me if I mispronounce that in any way. That's not a word at all. So thanks for the follows there, guys. You guys can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/NJNMpodcast, and Tyler runs that. All right, so let's go ahead and finish up the character name game before we get back into the media consume section. So the character's name was...
the character's name for this week is, for the character name game, Turner Lucas.
Turner Lucas, all right.
From a fairly popular film.
I'm going to say Rent.
Ugh, no.
Okay. I don't know. I'm thinking of characters that were in New Year's Eve, which is one of the big movies that came out this past weekend.
The first one you go to is Rent. That's not a good sign for New Year's Eve.
Well, I was thinking that maybe you picked John Bon Jovi, and I think he was in that movie. I don't know. I've never seen Rent, so I don't know.
I think he's in Bon Jovi, the band.
Yes, of course. All right.
He may rent his equipment. I don't know.
Turner Lucas. Was that Ashton Kutcher's character in Just Married?
No, it's not going to be one of the big people.
Oh, Lord. All right.
It's going to be like Seth Meyers' brother.
Is it Ryan Seacrest in any movie? Because I think he's in.
I picked the Ryan Seacrest character. Come on, dude. You don't know me at all.
All right. I don't know. Go ahead.
He's a popular rapper. He may have been in a movie with Queen Latifah about basketball.
What? I was going to say Ludacris.
You might have seen a billboard for it. Is Ludacris in New Year's Eve?
I don't know.
If he is, I might go see it.
I assume everybody's in New Year's Eve.
I'm a huge fan of Chris Ludacris Johnson.
Bridges. Chris Ludacris
Jeff Bridges. Bridges is in it too?
No, you're thinking of Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
The Rock's in New Year's Eve?
Son of a bitch!
The hell?
No, I don't know, Tyler. I'm not sure.
He's a popular rapper. He was in a movie with Queen Latifah about basketball. I think you may have seen the billboard for it numerous times. The movie that
Is it Just Right?
Wait, is that the basketball movie?
Yes.
Okay, who's the guy in that movie?
Like Tyrese or something?
I don't think that was him.
Okay, I don't know.
Okay, the movie that you're supposed to be guessing also stars Denzel Washington.
Wow. Okay. He Got Game.
I wish it was. Denzel Washington kind of plays a bad guy.
Training Day?
No, he kind of plays like an upscale mobster, perhaps.
Oh, is it American Gangster?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was Common's character in in American Gangster.
And Common is in New Year's Eve?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think him, Ludacris, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson like have like a three-way storyline going on. I'm not really sure. But no. If that's not enough to get you into theaters, I don't know what is.
That is not factual in any way.
Might be. You haven't seen the movie yet.
Okay. All right. Well, that was a disaster. I should probably apologize to listeners for...
What was the movie Common was in that I'm thinking of with Queen Latifah is the question now. And if you give me 2 seconds, I'll find out.
Yeah, I don't know. Let me look at
Common. He was also in Smoking Aces. He's also known as Common Sense. That might be false. He's from Chicago, born in 1972.
He was in Terminator Salvation. Queen Latifah wasn't in that.
No, she wasn't. I might have got him confused.
No, Just Right. That's it. Yeah, that's the Queen Latifah basketball movie.
Oh, yeah, there it is right there. Just Right, 2010. Scott McKnight.
Yeah.
Oh, yep, and that is a poster with Queen Latifah and a basketball. So, yeah, pretty awesome on my part to remember all that stuff.
Yeah.
Except the name of the film.
That's yeah.
Great.
Classic Tyler. All right, so let's move on into the media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching, any sort of cool events we've been to recently, or books or TV shows, movies, all that stuff. So what have you been consuming recently, Tyler?
Ooh, I get to talk some more. Great. As if that hasn't led us down paths untraveled so far. A couple of things I've been watching. Better Off Ted, another canceled series that's on Netflix that I'm checking out. It stars Portia de Rossi, the hot, but gay actress from Arrested Development.
Yep.
I think she's married to Ellen DeGeneres, or they hang out with each other. I don't know. I don't know how it works. And it also stars some other people I don't know. It's all right. I haven't written home about it yet, so we'll see.
Okay, so how would you compare that to the other series that you just watched recently with another member of Arrested Development, Running Wild?
I did finish up Running Wild. I like Felicity, and I like Will Arnett, and they need to bring that show back.
But in comparison to Better Off Ted, is it similar, different? What's the deal? Like, do you like one more than the other?
I'm still in like the first episodes of Better Off Ted. I mean, it takes place in like a big company.
Okay.
While Running Wild takes place in like Will Arnett's house. And kind of with his servant, so there's a whole other dynamic. But so far, it's kind of like just kind of office problems with this big company, not like The Office, but...
Is Better Off Ted a comedy?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It was on ABC.
Okay. I remember the name of the show, but I've never seen an episode and don't really remember anything about it, but...
Yeah, it's kind of one of those dialogue, like witty dialogue comedies.
Like Happy Endings?
Kind of. Happy Endings is pretty funny.
I don't know.
There's some funny parts in Better Off Ted, but
okay, all right.
Not great.
What else have you been watching?
Speaking of not that funny, but kind of funny, Last Man Standing with Tim Allen.
I think that just got canceled.
What?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just gonna say how good it was.
Pretty sure they just pulled all those episodes in favor of Man Up. More episodes of Man Up.
Oh, that show blows. Damn it. I like Tim Allen. I like his comedy. And I didn't have high hopes for this series. Mm-hmm. So I didn't add it to my DVR right away. And then I watched an on-demand episode. And I was like, okay, this is all right. I mean, it's Tim Allen. I mean, the rest of the characters are kind of, eh. But Tim Allen kind of carries the show. He's a little more ridiculous than he was on Tool Time, although he should have just been called Tim Taylor in this show. And he's got three daughters, and two of them are hot. One of them's underage, so I can't really say she's hot. The mom is from Becker, if you ever saw Becker with Ted Danson.
Nope.
She plays the cafe owner before the other cafe owner comes in the later seasons. I think she was in Three Men and a Baby, too. She's all right. I've never really cared for her, but I mean, she's okay. And then his boss that he works with is this old man, and they're pretty funny, the dynamic there. But if it's been canceled, I'm going to be pretty pissed about that, because I was just starting to kind of like it after this first half season. But
yeah.
And I did try watching Man Up. Oh, do you remember? Because I was like, okay, I'm going to watch that new Tim Allen show, Man Up. And then I watched an episode of Man Up, and I was like, wait a second, this isn't the Tim Allen show. And yes. That show blew. And mm-hmm. then I watched Last Man Standing, and I was like, okay, this is okay. I mean, it's not great. I can understand why it was canceled, but it's on like a weird night where nothing else is on. So why cancel it? I just don't get it.
Gotcha.
Put it on Fridays, man.
Yeah.
And then finally, I went and watched The Sitter with Jonah Hill, Fat Jonah Hill.
Okay, what did you think about that one?
It was pretty funny. I mean, it was... I can't really remember Adventures in Babysitting. Have you ever seen that?
I think I did when I was a little kid, but I don't really remember
it. Yeah. I think it was kind of like that from what I could recall, because Adventures in Babysitting was about somebody trying to find like a Playboy magazine, so I don't remember it being too like kid-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
Neither was this. I mean, you had little kids cussing, which I guess is funny. I don't know. But Jonah Hill is pretty funny in this. I didn't think I liked him too much. I like him a lot more than Seth Rogen, though, to compare like fat guys in comedy movies. I think they're easily confused, maybe. I don't know.
Well, they're both in the Apatow brand of comedy. So.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was coming from with that. But Jonah Hill, I mean, just his delivery and his lines are fairly humorous, and kind of the situations he gets into. He's got that calm kind of reaction to things,
mm-hmm.
where he just kind of says stuff, and it's kind of awkward, but it's funny. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then the Max Records is in it, the sorry sack of shite from Where the Wild Things Are.
Yep.
He continues his reign as the up-and-coming emo actor of the hipster generation. I don't know.
Okay.
And then, you know.
Are there any, like, crazy cameos? Don't tell me if like who there are, but just tell me if there are.
Are there crazy cameos? No, not really.
Okay. It seems like,
not like,
you know,
a Muppet movie or anything.
In Date Night, which seems like a movie that's kind of like maybe a little bit more of a watered-down version of The Sitter, Date Night starred Steve Carell and Tina Fey, and that was kind of a one crazy night type of movie. There was a couple like decent cameos in that one, so I just didn't know if they pulled like a similar stunt with this. But
nah, this is all Jonah Hill, which is, I guess, for the good of the movie. But
yeah,
I feel like it clocked out at like 85 minutes. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
Yesterday I went to the movies, and I was going to see Hugo in 3D,
mm-hmm.
and it was like 2 hours and something, and I was like, I wanted to come home and watch The Lord of the Rings. So I was like, okay. And I was sitting there at the movie theater. I had already bought my ticket, too. I actually had to go and, you know, exchange it.
Yeah.
And I was like, do I really want to watch, like, a Scorsese drama for 2 hours and then go home and watch Fellowship of the Ring?
Yeah.
And, like, The Sitter was starting, like, 5 minutes from where I was standing. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go with The Sitter on this one. So I have yet to see Hugo 3D.
Okay.
But, you know, if you're into, like, short movies that'll make you laugh and not really, you know, I don't want to say it doesn't challenge you, but it really doesn't. Like it's not a mental exercise to watch The Sitter. So if you're looking for that kind of movie, it might be a rental, or it might be like your girlfriend doesn't like long dramas about robots,
right?
Or whatever Hugo is. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, you can go see The Sitter. Yeah.
So The Sitter is directed by David Gordon Green. It's out in theaters right now.
I didn't even know that.
For me, the one movie that I got a chance to watch this week was Sherlock Holmes, the Robert Downey Jr., Jude Law, Guy Ritchie directed film from a couple years ago. Have you seen this movie, Tyler?
I've seen Sherlock Holmes 1.
Yes. I have not
Were
seen...
You talking about... Oh, you haven't seen the second one yet?
No, the second one, I watched this first one in preparation for a screening that I've got coming up this week of Sherlock Holmes 2. So it was just kind of refreshing my memory, because I'd only seen the first one one time in theaters, and that was it. So I wanted to rewatch it, kind of get familiar again with the characters and their dynamic and stuff like that. And I have to say, I like this movie a lot more the second time than I did the first time around. The first time, I think I had maybe higher expectations for the film, and kind of I don't know, I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. And I think after you see a movie and you kind of have an idea, a better idea of what it is and what it's trying to do, sometimes that can, those lowered expectations can kind of help the movie in further viewing. So I think that's what happened here. The dialogue between Holmes and Watson is fantastic, and those actors do a really, really great job. It's interesting seeing Downey come from, you know, the Tony Stark character in Iron Man to something that's a lot more heightened and more dramatic in and not dramatic in like a Hamlet type of way, but a dramatic and like very over the top, like
Stallone
theatrical type of way. Okay. That's the word I was looking for. So his delivery is very theatrical. Everything about the character of Sherlock Holmes as portrayed by Robert Downey Jr. is very theatrical. So I love the reveals of how he comes up with certain things and the flashbacks and kind of putting all that stuff together. And I was listening to the Slash Filmcast and they have said this a couple times, but it really stuck with me. They mentioned that writers, like characters in movies that are supposed to be super intelligent are only as smart as the writers of the movie, you know, like the writer can't write anybody smarter than themselves. So they did a really great job with Sherlock Holmes, the first one, in making Sherlock seem very intelligent and able to make these crazy connections and kind of put stuff together in a somewhat logical way. I mean, there are definitely some coincidences that kind of help him out along the way, but for the most part, it really showcases his intellect in a really great way and mixes in a bunch of great action and stuff as you would expect from any Guy Ritchie movie. So I liked this movie a lot more the second time around. I think if anybody saw it just once in the theater and was kind of turned off by it or didn't really appreciate it that much, I would encourage people to give it a second shot. And we'll see about the second one. We'll see if they can kind of recapture that that same humor and stuff that they did so well in the first one, or I don't know. The jury's still out on that one, so maybe I'll report back.
Is Amy Adams still hot in that one?
Amy Adams is not in it. You're thinking of Rachel McAdams, and she was...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking of Rachel McAdams.
She was very attractive in the
first one. That's a common mistake. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you that.
Amy Adams is the redhead. Rachel McAdams is the...
brunette.
We should both have them on the podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
Simultaneously.
Oh yeah, sure. We'll make
put that debate to rest, and then we'll have another episode: Seth Rogen versus Jonah Hill.
Awesome.
And we put that debate to rest. Yeah.
And then Julie Bowen and whoever that.
Oh yeah, Julie Bowen and Elizabeth Banks.
Yeah, Elizabeth Banks.
Head to head for the first time ever. You thought she was in Happy Gilmore, but she wasn't.
Awesome. All right. Well, that pretty much brings us to the end of this episode. So, Tyler, let's go back and forth and tell people where they can track down more of our work this week on the internet.
Well, like you said, I do the Twitter thing, I guess, fairly poorly. Not very funny. Although I am watching Fellowship of the Ring, so there will be a review of that, possibly with Ben's take somewhere involved.
Yep.
Hope maybe this week. And also at the Solar Sentinel, I wrote a top 5 Christmas tunes of 2011. I don't know if people even go to my site. So you can, and you can read Traherne's rant on Christmas music, at least for this year. These aren't like the top 5 best songs. These are just the songs that he's listening to this year.
Right. Course.
And now you can listen to.
And you can find that at thesolarsentinel.blogspot.com. For me, you can find my random thoughts and musings at twitter.com/benpairs. You can read my writing on geektyrant.com, filmonic.com, notjustnewmovies.com, the namesake for this podcast, and you can also hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast. I also wanted to throw out a shout out since we're getting close to Christmas here. It's the middle of December. I know Christmas music is in full swing, so if people want to listen to maybe an alternate take on some Christmas music, Tyler and I recently, if you guys are big fans of the podcast, you might know, you might follow the Not Just New Movies After Midnight section of the podcast, which is this kind of ancillary thing that we do, where we just talk about random stuff that doesn't really apply to the movie-related conversations here. And if anybody has listened to those episodes, you might be familiar with the characters of Jeff Worthington and Horace Smith that Tyler and I created years ago. We've been slowly releasing some of their audio adventures to you guys in the
After Midnight. Where are you going with this, Ben?
Well, I'm just setting it up for the Christmas album that you and I recorded as these characters a few years ago. And people can find all of these songs at jeffandhorace.tumblr.com. So feel free if you're looking for some more Christmas music with some, you know, I would say funny banter thrown in. People can find that stuff and it's all free. So check it out there. So that's pretty much going to bring us to the end of this episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be watching BKO Bangkok Knockout for next week. So that should be interesting if you're a big fan of the – the Thai action movie genre, that will be like Christmas morning to you. So there you go.
It'll be like our last Christmas episode. What was what?
Rumble in the Bronx.
Rumble in the Bronx and Super Cop 3. Something.
I think so. Yeah.
I think it was. Yeah. And we'll do it the same way. We'll watch a kung fu or karate movie, whatever you want to call it.
I liked it.
And we're probably going to have Panther Joe on. So if you're a big fan of Panther Joe, but not us, come back and listen to that episode.
If you're desperate for him to start his own podcast and desperate for us to stop doing ours, then
yeah,
it'll be pretty great. But all right, in any case, thanks for listening, everybody. We will catch y'all next week.
All the way home, I'll be warm. The fire is slowly dying. And my dear, we're still goodbying. But as long as you love me so, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.